Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Trump's travel ban halted, a senator silenced, and new uproar over ethics. Two courts say no to President Trump's travel ban. He tweets, "See you in court."
We'll see them in court. It's a political decision, and we're going to see them in court.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren was silenced on the Senate floor and accused of impugning a peer as she condemned Jeff Sessions' nomination for Attorney General.
Mr. President, I am surprised that the words of Coretta Scott King are not suitable for debate in the United States Senate.
And more fire over ethics as President Trump attacked Nordstrom for dropping his daughter's fashion label. Kellyanne Conway jumped in the fray to promote Ivanka's line. At a raucous town hall meeting in Utah, Congressman Jason Chaffetz, chairman of the House Oversight Committee, was shouted down for not investigating President Trump. This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Margaret Brennan, Aaron Blake, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What fate do you see for the travel ban? Do you want a president attacking a department store for his daughter? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington, Margaret Brennan, foreign affairs and White House correspondent for CBS News. Margaret, wonderful to have you here again.
Hi, Tom.
And joining us from Washington is Aaron Blake, senior political reporter on The Fix for The Washington Post. Aaron, welcome back.
It's good to be here, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Margaret, and Aaron.
Margaret, first to you on the president and the travel ban and the courts. Where does this stand? We had the ruling out of Washington that put a restraining order on the whole thing, and then the Ninth Circuit Court coming in and saying, we uphold that. Now the president's tweeting angrily at them, saying just in the last couple of hours, a disgraceful decision. What happens now, Margaret?
Well, the president has vowed to take it to the Supreme Court if need be, but there's also some talk about whether the White House lawyers could make some tweaks in the language that would avoid having to go to what is essentially a split court right now. Remember that the Supreme Court nominee, Judge Gorsuch, has not been confirmed yet, so that means we don't have an odd number. We have an even number of judges, potentially putting you in a position where you don't have a clear decision here, thus going to the lower courts and gets us back into this sort of tangled argument. But where we are right now, as the White House would say it, is this has not been a judgment on the merits or the constitutionality of the case itself as to whether the president has the right, based on national security concerns, to halt travel from certain countries. They believe they can win that argument. Right now, in these federal courts, it's a back and forth about whether the travel ban should be in place while they have that other argument about constitutionality of it and whether or not the president's basic description as a candidate and then in a subsequent interview as president describing this ban as being aimed at prioritizing Christians. Remember, as a candidate, he also said this was about banning Muslims. Does that intent make the language of the executive order itself get interpreted in a different way? Because the legal language there is specific to seven countries, then banning all refugees for 4 months and then totally halting all Syrians for an indefinite period of time.
Aaron, the appeals court in San Francisco did go to the assertion out of the White House that this was a national security issue for the executive, not the courts. And they said it is beyond question that the federal judiciary retains the authority to adjudicate constitutional challenges to executive action. They were not having this notion that they had no business here, Aaron.
I thought that was a really significant part of this, and it was basically in response to something that's been happening outside the courts, which is that President Trump has, for lack of a better term, been attacking the neutrality and the independence of the judiciary, saying that politics have seeped into this process, almost setting up a clash of sorts between the executive branch and the judicial branch. And they sent a very strong message, and one which I think most everybody who believes in the judicial branch would agree with and isn't within the judicial branch would agree with, which is that that the judicial branch does have the authority to review these things. That's not in question. The question is really whether they have the ability to stop this particular thing that the president has done. And I expect that we're going to be seeing this kind of a clash repeatedly, especially if President Trump continues to push the envelope as far as his executive authority goes.
Jack, now this doesn't necessarily go to the Supreme Court, but it well may. I want to come back and look at the president's attitude toward the courts and his own Supreme Court nominee's apparent response to that. But on a Supreme Court visit, if that's what ends up here, Jack, and the travel ban is there, the high court right across from Congress, what are the prospects? Are we, you know, we famously don't have a ninth member since Merrick Garland was not confirmed last year and Judge Gorsuch is not yet confirmed, or if he's to be confirmed. What happens in the high court if this shows up there? 4-4 tie and then what?
Well, if it's a 4-4 tie and the there's no other appeals court ruling, then the San Francisco ruling would stand because that's the way the system works. Whether the court will even take it on an emergency expedited basis is a question, because in order to get that, to make that this threshold decision, the court needs five votes. So it's a kind of catch-22. To get to five, even on that question, might be difficult. So we just don't know what's going to happen there.
And meanwhile, there's a lot of talk about how the president has been sort of trash-talking the courts. Now, he might say, well, they're trashing my policy here. But he's been very tough on the courts, saying they're biased, they're political. Here he was on Wednesday stepping up that criticism.
I don't ever want to call a court biased, so I won't call it biased. And we haven't had a decision yet. But courts seem to be so political, and it would be so great for our justice system if they would be able to read a statement and do what's right. And that has to do with the security of our country, which is so important.
Aaron, I don't want to call it biased, so I won't call it biased, but it's political, which kind of means biased.
This was President Trump not so subtly calling the courts biased. I mean, he said he's not doing it, but that's basically what he was getting at, and it's what he's been getting at for the better part of the last week here, ever since the judge in Washington State, the federal judge, ruled that the travel ban would be halted. He's been barking up this tree, calling him a so-called judge, questioning the authority of the court, saying that, you know, even in that quote that you played, he said that politics has seeped into the judiciary. So it's not clear what his end game is here, but he does seem to be hinting at kind of, you know, questioning the very authority of these judges to question his authority. And I think that's a, you know, we look at his tweet from after the court's ruling last night. Trump said, "We'll see you in court." That was actually maybe among the more reassuring things that people who are concerned about his rhetoric about the judiciary have seen, because he's actually saying that they're going to fight this in court as opposed to talking about the judges in a more political way.
And then, Margaret, we had this very interesting specter of his own Supreme Court nominee, Judge Neil Gorsuch, being quoted as having said that that you have to be careful about the judiciary being disheartened. He finds it disheartening and demoralizing when the executive or people go after the courts appeared to mean Donald Trump. He talked with Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal, who talked with ABC News yesterday about that conversation.
There's no question that Judge Gorsuch said that these attacks on the judiciary are disheartening and demoralizing. Needn't believe me, there were White House staff in the room, and his own spokesman confirmed afterward.
There's a Democratic senator, but also a Republican senator, Margaret, Ben Sasse, Nebraska, on MSNBC, with a similar reporting a similar kind of conversation with the Supreme Court nominee, Judge Gorsuch.
I asked him about the so-called judges comment, because we don't have so-called judges or so-called presidents or so-called senators. And this is a guy who kind of welled up with some energy, and he said any attack on any of, I think his term to me was, brothers or sisters of the robe is an attack on all judges, and he believes in an independent judiciary.
This is interesting, Margaret. Now, you've got Judge Gorsuch appearing in these quotes to kind of being being critical of President Trump's comments on the judiciary. White House denying that, saying that's not exactly or that's not what he intended to say. The first reports, I think, out of his own camp and even out of the White House saying, no, that is what he was doing. Where does this stand, Margaret?
Well, I can parse the spin or try to there, but I think the bottom line among some very skeptical Democrats is they think they got played here because the bottom line from these remarks is that Judge Gorsuch now looks independent from Donald Trump, the president who appointed him, the very controversial president who many Democrats have vowed to oppose on this nomination. And because of that, now Judge Gorsuch creates at least the perception, if not the reality, of a divide between him and the president, that he's independent enough to stand up for his own convictions and his interpretation and his defense of the Constitution, rather than just simply doing what the president of the United States, who appointed him, wants him to do. So this may actually help the judge win the votes he needs to get confirmed. But you're right. The White House spin has been, well, the president wasn't attacking the judiciary. He wasn't doing anything that past presidents haven't done in terms of his ability to criticize and have some dissent there. But that so-called judge tweet is really the fly in the ointment here, because that does look very personally motivated, and that's what makes this really an issue for someone like Judge Gorsuch and all the senators who he's now courting to win the support of. So the spin back from those who have been trying to help shepherd him through is that, yes, he indeed said this was disheartening and demoralizing, but it wasn't personal to Trump or specific. It was all taxed on the judiciary or something he doesn't like.
Jack, in this week, when the president and weekend more, when the president has been so fierce in his attacks on the judiciary, it's pretty hard to separate these things.
Oh, yes. I mean, there's and you talk about spin. I mean, there's an exquisite gyroscope applied to that one. That's for sure. Yes, but you know, there is something to cheer here. I mean, Mr. Trump has asserted, his lawyer asserted, that the national security concerns, decisions are unreviewable. The court says, no, that's contrary to the fundamental structure of our constitutional democracy. There's a vindication there against even creeping autocracy.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. The courts say no to President Trump's travel ban. Jeff Sessions, Betsy DeVos, Tom Price, all confirmed this week. Kellyanne Conway hawks Ivanka's stuff. The president says Russia, U.S., all the same, and Elizabeth Warren silenced for reading Coretta Scott King. We've got a lot to look at here. Margaret Brennan is with us, foreign affairs and White House correspondent for CBS News. Aaron Blake, senior political reporter on The Fix for The Washington Post. Jack Beatty is here. You can join us. Can you believe the president is out there tweeting about Nordstrom, that Kellyanne Conway, counselor to the president, is out there shilling for Ivanka's clothing line? What about the confirmations this week? Mike Pence bringing it home for Betsy DeVos, Tom Price and his stock trades, now Secretary Price, Jeff Sessions, now Attorney General of the United States. And what do you think about the Senate shutting down Senator Elizabeth Warren, reading Coretta Scott King's letter from 30 years ago? Margaret, Aaron, Jack, we've got callers from around the country on the courts and the president, Leah, the travel ban. Leah in New Orleans, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Yeah, what do you think?
To everyone that's on the line with you.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Leah?
I'm calling about the travel ban. I actually have a lot of immigrants in my family from Palestine, so they are Arab, first generation. And I've also worked in the hotel and restaurant industry for about 15 years and worked with plenty of immigrants. They bring tons of value to our city. They've always been hardworking and kind and given back to our community. And I absolutely agree with the Ninth Circuit Court, their ruling. I think that it was fair and just, and, you know, more consideration needs to be taken when putting in these executive orders and without notifying the proper agencies on how to act. And people should still be allowed to come in. I mean, we just saw that 13,000 people have been hung in Syrian prisons. So these are people that are fleeing persecution in their own countries, and they deserve a chance after being vetted to continue their process.
Leah, I appreciate your call. That was compelling and terrible reporting out of the sort of torture camp in Syria this week, with thousands of hangings reported there. And what a way to go. I appreciate your call from New Orleans. There's one view on the travel ban. One more. Columbus, Georgia. Robert, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Margaret Brennan, Aaron Blake, Jack Beatty.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Appreciate you taking the call. just a comment about the ban. The judicial branch of the government's the truly neutral part of the government. The executive and the Congress may or may not be neutral. So for the president to attack, of course, the only 100% neutral branch of the government, to me, he is being political, not the judge. And I just hope that you and everyone stresses the Constitution is what we all must be ruled by. Anything contrary to the Constitution is politically motivated.
Robert, we've got it, and I appreciate your call as well. Aaron Blake, we like to think of the courts as 100% neutral, but the President of the United States has been saying something quite different this week. We heard him again as he was going through a lobby or something there saying, very political, very political. And, of course, we've seen a politicized nomination and confirmation process. Do the courts still carry that mantle? If it comes to a who's more political contest between the White House and the courts, where do we stand, Aaron?
Well, of course, politics permeate pretty much everything having to do with policy in this country. That includes the judiciary. There is a reason why you tend to see the same justices on one side of a vote and same justices on the other side of a vote repeatedly. It's not supposed to be a political process, but our politics derive from our worldview and our interpretation of what a law should be. And so judges who tend to favor a more strict interpretation tend to be more conservative. Judges who tend to be more willing to read more into the law and look at things beyond the actual words that are written tend to agree with liberals. So, Trump is right in a sense here that there is politics involved in this process, but I would say that this is a common argument that is made that when you disagree with the court's decision, it's dismissed as a political decision. And when the court says what you want, it's not a political decision. It's a lot more complicated than that. And I think that, this hammer that people wield of saying that something is political is a little bit oversimplifying everything.
Margaret, it is very notable, though, how fiercely the president's gone after the courts, how cuttingly. After really any institution, whether it's the press or the courts, that has a kind of could exercise a sort of critical restraint over his powers.
It is. I mean, just last night I was at the White House after this decision came down, and the president walked through a corridor nearby Sean Spicer's office where all the journalists were gathered looking for any kind of statement to respond to the court decision. And the president stopped and spoke to reporters, including CBS, and said, this is a political decision in his view by the courts. He thinks that ultimately they're going to fight and they're going to be able to win. He believes this is all about security and that this is in some ways something that in my interpretation is that he takes personally because he truly believes, as did the lawyers who vetted it, that they had the law on their side in terms of presidential power here. The problem, of course, in terms of the logistics and the messy way that this was handled in the rollout in terms of those crowds at the airports and the protests, all of that really drew public scrutiny to how this executive order was rolled out without the relevant agencies really knowing fully how to implement it and without fully being briefed. The more time passes, perhaps some of that public outrage dissipates a bit. And maybe this does become simply about the merits of the case. A lawyer could tell you that better. But the president certainly seems to be feeling this in a personal way in terms of the comments he's made over the past week. He stood before a group of sheriffs and police officers here in Washington and just read off the law and went off extensively to talk about how he thinks, as you played that clip, that this is essentially a biased situation here.
But Jack, you had a bunch of national security people this week coming out and saying, this isn't about national security. This is about politics. The president's playing politics here with his policy. It won't make the country safer.
Yes. I mean, in his charge, politics, that's the essential Trump defense mechanism, projection. He always accuses other people of the thing that he's doing. I mean, look, this policy, and by the way, to the political charge, of the four just judges involved, two were appointed by Republican presidents. So it's not like if they're all Democrats.
Yeah.
But this policy, remember, its genesis was right after the San Bernardino attack. When Mr. Trump said we're going to have shutdown of all Muslims coming into the country, it was, as Charles Krauthammer put it, a barstool eruption. With no that flew in the face of establishment clause and everybody, Paul Ryan, everyone, oh, we can't have that. And so they worked out they smoothed it out with Rudy Giuliani. Oh, we'll just make it country specific and it won't be. But the problem with that, as the court pointed out, is the countries involved have posed no terrorist threat. There's no evidence from the past of their refugees from these places or visa card holders from these places creating problems, terrorism, and so it's just it's a fiction that we're all involved. That somehow this is a national security threat from these countries.
That's one way of seeing it. Though the Obama administration called them terror threat countries. We've got a lot to look at here. I want to go to Larry in Afton, Virginia. Larry, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom and guests. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I've been a small businessman for over 40 years, and my comment is that this is the most corrupt administration in the history of the U.S.
What are you talking about?
I'm talking about Betsy DeVos, who essentially purchased her cabinet seat with $200 million in contributions to Republican candidates. You can move right over to Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price, who in any fair world would be in prison for his insider trading, having done far more than Martha Stewart ever did, and yet now he's a cabinet secretary. You can move right over to Steve Mnuchin, who conveniently forgot on his financial disclosure form to reveal $100 million in assets, and he forgot it. But it all stems from the president, who's been sued by George Bush's ethics attorney. I want to repeat that, George Bush's ethics attorney.
Larry, you got it. You're well-versed, and we've got it. And we know this litany. What do you think about the ethics issues this week? People talking a lot about the president on Nordstrom and Kellyanne Conway?
This feeds right to Nordstrom's. Absolutely. I've been in business for 41 years. Businesses make decisions on business. If Ivanka Trump's line is causing them problems and not selling well, they get to drop it without the president attacking them publicly. What kind of stuff is this?
The president tweeting this week, "My daughter Ivanka has been treated so unfairly by Nordstrom. She's a great person. Always pushing me to do the right thing. Terrible." That was up on the formal POTUS, President of the United States, Twitter account as well. Yeah, it's something unusual, Larry, and I appreciate your call. And then it went further on Fox on Thursday after Nordstrom had dropped that clothing line, Ivanka's clothing line. White House counselor Kellyanne Conway encouraged on the air. This is from a White House briefing room. Encouraged viewers to buy Ivanka Trump's products. An endorsement which some say violates law prohibiting employees of the government's executive branch from using their status to sell a product. Here was Conway.
It's a wonderful line. I own some of it. I'm going to give a free commercial here. Go buy it today, everybody. You can find it online.
From the White House, Sean Spicer, White House press secretary, with this little bit came out saying she's getting some guidance on the matter.
She's been counseled on that subject, and that's it.
That's it. I don't know if that's it. Margaret, that was kind of extraordinary. The whole thing, the president going after department store, Kellyanne Conway saying go buy Ivanka's stuff. What's going on there?
Well, it's interesting because as soon as Kellyanne Conway said that on the airwaves and then the White House said she had been counseled, it really shifted the focus away from what the president had done using the official Twitter account, as well, as you pointed out, something that's going to be, you know, kept in federal records. To endorse his daughter's clothing line and personally attack an American corporation, a publicly traded one, which impacted for at least a short bit what they were trading at. But Kellyanne Conway switched the conversation back to her. She is a fierce defender of the president of the United States, and I'm sure her display of loyalty was received as such. But it's a big problem for ethics lawyers who say you can't stand in front in the White House briefing room, a podium and a room that is used to really represent America to the world and talk about a personal business interest that the family of the president of the United States seeks to benefit from directly here. So we also heard, and was interesting, on Capitol Hill, Jason Chaffetz, who oversees House Oversight, who had just been at the White House a few days earlier, had to come out and say, whoa, this steps over the line here. This is something that we cannot have. I mean, this wasn't subtle in any way, shape, or form. But look, this is the thing with covering Donald Trump moment to moment. The story changes. And if the White House really does want this to be an administration taken seriously for the policy and its implications as to what it's doing for the American people, keep the conversation there. Conversations about what's selling at Nordstrom is actually a distraction.
Amen. But wow, just the very fact of a president tweeting about that and going after a department store, a lot to look at here. Jason Chaffetz saying that's too much, Utah congressman, of course. About Kellyanne Conway. But, you know, he also got a real sort of jolt this week. He was back home for a town hall meeting in Utah, in Salt Lake City yesterday. Here's the crowd. Here's him and the crowd after he had said that he could not investigate President Trump's conflicts of interest as chairman of the House Oversight Committee.
Let me tell you something you're really not going to like. You want to hear this? Hold on. You're really not going to like this part. The president, under the law, is exempt from the conflict of interest laws. He's exempt.
Whoa, and that crowd was really on fire. Do your job, do your job, they were chanting earlier. Aaron Blake, this is all over the web. Sweaty 75 minutes for Congressman Chaffetz there.
Yes, it was, and I thought that was interesting. That came the same day that he basically delivered a pretty strong rebuke of what Kellyanne Conway had said about Nordstrom. I think it's
worth
pointing.
What about the president?
Right. But it's worth pointing out that what Congressman Chaffetz said is technically true. The president is exempt from the conflict of interest laws that members of Congress and even members of his own cabinet face. So there's not a whole lot of things to nail him down on besides something like the emoluments clause, which is, you know, if a foreign payment is made benefiting the president. And of course, there are people who would like for him and other people to pursue that. But I think this whole thing and Kellyanne Conway's whole thing is just further proof that this conflict of interest thing is not going away. There are way too many, strands in this spider web of Trump's fortune. The White House is not making much of an effort to insulate themselves from these questions. And this is going to be a continued subject of debate, possibly of investigation, when it comes to members of the administration, if not Trump himself. And so I think that by not creating more distance between himself and his business, by putting it in the charge of his children and tweeting about these things, Trump is just inviting this to be a continued headache for him going forward. And what we saw was exactly what Kellyanne Conway did this week, which I think Sean Spicer's reaction suggested pretty strongly was not okay.
It's a lot to ask Americans to turn a blind eye to. Farouk in Urbana, Illinois. Farouk, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Tom, for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm also concerned about I agree with the prior caller who said that this is the most corrupt administration in our history, and that the fish stinks rots from the head. But I'm particularly concerned about the attitude of Congress towards this, because I think that Congressman Chaffetz is being disingenuous when he says, well, the president is exempt. He's exempt from that specific law, but he's not exempt from the Constitution, and he's not exempt from the standards that govern our system generally. With regard specifically to the Emoluments Clause, the Constitution requires that the president may not receive foreign emoluments without the consent of Congress. So if Congress thinks that this is not a problem, then they need to authorize him. They need to give him permission to receive these emoluments. And if they're not willing to give him that permission, then he has to stop. But Congress doesn't get the luxury of just hiding in the background and looking the other way. They have to be front and center on this, either authorize him to receive the payments or require him to stop receiving the payments. And if he refuses to stop receiving the payments without authorization, then that's grounds for impeachment.
Well, we'll see where it goes and where the money is here, what Congress really steps up to do. Jack Beatty, quite a spectacle this week.
It was. Congressman Chaffetz, I'm impressed that he at least came right around on that one ethics question, not on the broader question that Farouk ingeniously raises there. Give us, say it's okay or impeach him seems to be the constitutional alternative.
Well, I mean, I'm just still slapping my forehead about a president attacking a department store. I can't get used to this yet, but here we are. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Rocket Mortgage provides a transparent online process that helps you understand all the details of your home loan. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the right mortgage solution for you. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a blizzard hit the Northeast on Thursday, blanketing most of the region with more than a foot of snow here on Cape Cod.
People here have been in the thick of this blizzard most of the day with heavy snow and high winds not only whipping up those waves, but leaving many people here without power.
That's some kind of wind. On the Tonight Show, Jimmy Fallon ribbed President Trump for going after Nordstrom.
This morning, President Trump actually went on Twitter to criticize Nordstrom for dropping his daughter Ivanka's line and treating her unfairly. And while Trump's tweeting about a department store, a lot of people are wondering what the return policy is for presidents. And they go, yeah.
And the New England Patriots with quarterback Tom Brady and here running back James White captured a stunning Super Bowl victory, coming back from 25 points down.
Toss to White. He's in! Patriots win the Super Bowl! Brady has his fifth!
What a comeback, indeed. We're looking at a week in the news. The courts and Donald Trump's travel ban, the president's travel ban, Sessions, DeVos, Price, all confirmed Kellyanne and Ivanka's stuff. The president says the Russia and U.S. Killers all over the place. Elizabeth Warren silenced for reading Coretta Scott King. Aaron Blake is with us from The Washington Post. Margaret Brennan from CBS News. Jack Beatty is here. There was that amazing moment this week, Aaron, where Senator Elizabeth Warren was in the run-up to the vote on the nomination of Jeff Sessions, Alabama senator, former prosecutor down there, to be Attorney General of the United States. She was reading a 30-year-old letter from Coretta Scott King. And as she sort of rolled into this, suddenly out come the Senate rules, and she is tossed right out of the chamber for impugning a fellow member of the Senate. When was that last done, Aaron? Any idea?
Well, it's a very infrequently used rule. I would note there was a time a couple years ago when Ted Cruz was on the floor calling Mitch McConnell a liar, and the rule was not used back then, even though it was much more of a clear-cut case. This seems to be something that is used when it is convenient and when the leaders decide that it's going to be useful to them. I think in this particular case, there is a compelling argument to be made that what Elizabeth Warren was reading was, perhaps against the spirit, against the decorum that usually exists in the Senate.
Wait a minute. Let's hold it right there. This was a letter from history that was written to the Senate by the widow of Dr. Martin Luther King about actual historical facts that transpired in Alabama, where Jeff Sessions was accused of bringing charges against people who were trying to bring in voters. That doesn't sound like if that's not relevant to a nomination of an attorney general, what is?
Yeah, it's a very good question. The question is whether Warren's words themselves were impugning Sessions or the words in the letter were impugning Sessions. I think that's an important philosophical debate to have. I also think, though, from just a purely political standpoint, by silencing Warren, McConnell gave her a platform essentially to rally the troops and to really make an issue of this. And given the fact that Sessions' nomination was going to go through, I'm not sure that there needed to be this big spectacle made out of the whole thing. And I think you know, McConnell is a student of the rules and likes to wield them in the ways that are beneficial to him, and he knows them better than basically anybody. But in this case, it may have been better just to let this one slide and to not make it more news than it needed to be.
Senator Warren stepped out into the hallway and read that letter anyway on Facebook Live. Millions and millions of views there. Here she was. This is Curtis Scott King's, just a little bit of this 1986 letter, which was very critical of a younger Jeff Sessions.
The irony of Mr. Sessions' nomination is that, if confirmed, he will be given life tenure for doing with a federal prosecution what local sheriffs accomplished 20 years ago with clubs and cattle prods.
Tough language from Coretta Scott King. Margaret Brennan, what's going on here? Is gender part of this? Is Elizabeth Warren singled out because she's a woman and these guys don't want to hear that tone of voice?
Well, it depends where you stand in terms of how you perceive this. But certainly that is what Senator Warren has suggested, given that others have been allowed to read this letter on the floor of the Senate before, most of the mail, and that also happened after she was shut down here. But the point is made, is it were they her words or were they Coretta Scott King's words that were of issue here? Bottom line for her is that Mitch McConnell did a major favor by elevating her status in so many ways. It stole the spotlight away from Jeff Sessions, the new attorney general, and put it back on a very prominent Democrat whose profile has only been increased through this incident. But as to exactly what McConnell was thinking, not clear, and not clear if it had anything to do with gender, but it certainly has elevated the senator he tried to silence.
Polly in Randolph, Ohio. Polly, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I think one good thing that came out of that whole incident with Elizabeth Warren came from Coretta Scott King's daughter, where she indicated it's time to start looking at all of these actions and words by our president, Republican President Trump, with all the other Senate and Congress representatives who are also Republican. It's time to start stop disassociating them. They're all one. And it's the Congress's responsibility to have some oversight on the executive branch, and they're not doing that. So if we start lumping all of Republican President Trump's words and deeds with all the other Republicans in the Senate and the House, I think they're going to have to start to take accountability and responsibility.
We will see where it goes. Jeff Sessions, now Attorney General of the United States, he talked yesterday after his swearing in the Oval Office, said, the new Attorney General, that America has a major problem with violent crime. It's time to do something about it.
I wish the rise that we're seeing in crime in America today were some sort of aberration or a blip. My best judgment, having been involved in criminal law enforcement for many years, is that this is a dangerous, permanent trend.
Can we stop right there? Margaret Brennan, what is the new Attorney General talking about? Since 1991, we've seen the overall trend dramatically down in violent crime in this country, a very tiny uptick in 2015. But he's talking about this rise. He's saying a permanent trend. What's he referring to?
Well, this is something that President Trump himself got tripped up by in the past week, actually, or week and a half. Gosh, the days are all blending together now. With looking at statistics in terms of absolute level versus rate of change, it does not appear, when you look at the FBI data, that those comments match with the rate of increase. In fact, actually, violent crime, specifically murder and rape, down closer to a decade's low than what is being described. But there is, particularly in major cities and particularly year on year, there has been some real concern. And so when the Attorney General, when the President try to explain how they got those numbers wrong or why they don't match with FBI data, they draw the attention back to, well, look at places where it's extremely acute, gang-related violence or murder rate spikes in places like Chicago. That's a favorite example that's often pointed to there. And the President has even threatened to, it's not clear, but he said, send in the feds if this isn't brought under control. What does that mean, actually? We don't know. But it resonates for some Americans who apparently feel less safe, even though the FBI would tell you you're actually more.
Well, I mean, that feeling can come from a lot of directions. Jack Beatty, it was remarkable to me. I mean, he's talking about seeing a, you know, rising crime in America is what the new attorney general said. And to assert, he said again there, this is a dangerous, permanent trend. When you look at the trend line, it is dramatically down for what, 10, 20, 30, 30, 35 years?
Yes, according to the fact checker today, it's closer to 57-year low in violent crime, 57-year low. But this is the Trump way. You know, Robert Solow, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, recently was quoted, not about Trump, but about sort of crackpot theories. He says, suppose somebody at a party comes up to you and he says, I'm Napoleon. Do you then sit down and discuss infantry tactics with Napoleon? No, you don't. And yet, again and again, Mr. Trump and his myrmidons come out and say, in effect, I'm Napoleon. There is this crime wave. There isn't. Yes, there's been these blips. And then we all...
I mean, pretty nasty blips in some cities. Chicago
indeed,
doesn't look good.
Indeed. But you can hear the footfalls there. Of a extension of federal power, Margaret just referenced it, that could be indeed very ominous, and I'm afraid that's the predicate there on the basis of this essentially false hypothesis about the world. They're ready to make some real and perhaps dangerous intervention.
I want to go to Jared in Jericho, Vermont. Jared, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. While it's important to keep our eye on the daily onslaught of ethics violations and undermining of the judiciary, I just encourage everyone to keep a focus on this Russia thing, too. The recent reporting of Michael Flynn's conversation with the Russian ambassador prior to Trump's election regarding sanctions, Trump's shady past with the Russians and a lack of understanding about his financial connections there. He always defaults to, well, we're going to ally with Russia to fight ISIS. Let's just walk down that road a little bit. You know, the only alliances that Russia really has in the world are with Bashar al-Assad and the Iranians. So what would an alliance fighting Russia look like exactly? We'll align ourselves with a butcher who recently found out that, you know, killed an additional 13,000 people in a slaughterhouse and has killed 600,000 of his own people.
That was rough news this week, and it's a long trend there. That is true. Margaret Brennan, what about the news this week that General Flynn, the National Security Advisor, talked with the Russian ambassador about the U.S. lifting sanctions potentially on Russia, or indicating that in a conversation in December before inauguration even taken place? What do we know, Margaret?
Well, this is putting National Security Advisor Michael Flynn in a very difficult spot with his own administration, because remember, not only did he deny that he ever spoke about sanctions, he had the Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence, go on CBS News and go elsewhere and say that he was confident that Michael Flynn actually did not discuss this very thing with the Russian ambassador. So he clearly told others that this was not the case. However, the reporting, though the White House has said, yes, that Michael Flynn did speak to the Russian ambassador prior to inauguration. Nothing wrong with that. It's the content of the phone call itself. And what is interesting here, if this is accurate, and I have no reason to believe it is not, given the number of former U.S. officials who have now come forward to confirm it, is that Michael Flynn should know most foreign diplomats are well aware that their phone calls are perhaps monitored by U.S. services here, and that it would be able to see not only that there was a call that took place, but perhaps actual record of what was discussed during it. So for Flynn to have denied something that he could have known was demonstrably false or true puts him in a sticky spot.
Is that illegal for him to do that when he's not, you know, a private citizen? About negotiating, you know, doing diplomacy when you're not in power?
There's a very rarely enforced law that would prohibit an official from trying to undermine policy, the Logan Act. But obviously here what has raised eyebrows is that this suggests some sort of some sort of conspiring, I don't know if that's the right word, with Russian officials to undermine existing policy. And for Vladimir Putin to have reacted so softly to President Obama's sanctions to punish the cyber hacking. Remember, that's what this was about. President Obama came out very strongly saying this cannot happen. This is why we're kicking out your diplomats. This is why we're sanctioning you. Vladimir Putin took this step back and looked kind of like the bigger guy and said, well, I'm not going to do the typical reciprocal move of punishing American diplomats. And so that's really what raised eyebrows to say, wait a second, what has been promised to the Russians here in terms of perhaps lifting further sanctions? And so far, the Trump administration hasn't answered that question. They've only said they'll keep the Crimea-related sanctions on Russia. They've been squishier about whether those other sanctions related to the cyber hacking are up for negotiation.
Margaret, can I ask you, while we've got you, there seem to be a lot of leaks coming out of this White House. Now, that one may have not have been from the Trump administration, but many things coming out do seem to tie back to the Trump administration. What's going on? Am I right that seems like a big number? And what's going on? Who's leaking what here, Margaret?
Well, look, there are a few things going on. There's no I think people are well aware that there are a lot of competing entities within the White House for the president's attention, and perhaps that not only do they have competing portfolios, but they have competing agendas. That is what appears to be the case in many ways. But you also have to remember, some of these reports and these leaks that are coming forward are coming from people who are not in any way political. Some of them, some of these law enforcement leaks and elsewhere, these are career officials and who are saying, we are concerned. In many cases, whether they're talking to people on Capitol Hill or whether they're talking to journalists or whether they're talking elsewhere. And unfortunately, from what the White House has been signaling, they don't trust anyone who didn't come along with them for the ride. So unless you were part of Team Trump all the way, you're being shut out in many ways is what we are hearing. And what's unfortunate about that is that there are people who do have some institutional knowledge and really could help weigh in on some decisions that would perhaps avoid some self-inflicted wounds for the Trump administration, whether it's diplomatically or elsewhere. The executive order rollout is a perfect example of that. If more people had known about exactly how to implement this, maybe it wouldn't have been quite so messy on the rollout. So you've got this pushback from the Trump administration trying to hold on and prevent leaks. But unfortunately, in doing so, they might be hurting themselves in the long run.
Aaron Blake, Bowling Green Massacre. Kellyanne Conway, again, making headlines through this week and said that was a slip of the tongue. You're reporting, no, she'd said it several times, this massacre that never actually happened.
Yeah, they tried to play this off as a little bit, you know, her saying massacre instead of terrorists. We found out that she had said it twice in the days before. I think just another example of, even if the White House isn't necessarily being dishonest about things, they don't have much control over their message, and it seems to smell a little bit of amateurism.
Hard to keep up with the news lately, but we're giving it our best shot, and we're very grateful to all of you for being with us to do that. Aaron Blake, senior political reporter with The Fix at The Washington Post. Aaron, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Margaret Brennan at CBS News. Always great to have you here, Margaret.
Good to talk to you.
And Jack Beatty, many thanks. Thanks for joining us today, Jack.
Thank you.
Listeners, next Friday, I'll be broadcasting from WDET in Detroit as our Listening to America tour continues in the Motor City. Tune in for that. We'll be there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.